Today I'd like to talk about persecution and martyrdom. The Apostle Paul reminded Timothy that anyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. 2 Timothy 3:12. That's not just an apostle he's referring to, or someone who's a missionary. Jesus also said in John 15, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they'll obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of my name, for they do not know the one who sent me." Like Paul, Jesus explains that persecution is part of the Christian life. The world pushes back when we try to advance the teaching of Christ. When we're worldly, the world has no problem with us. It loves us as its own. And yet God has called us to be different. He's chosen us out of the world. And that's why persecution and even martyrdom are part of the Christian life. I'd like to begin by sharing a few types of persecution that were common in the early church, maybe even today, seven in all. And then we'll talk about martyrdom and what that means. And we'll look at the lives of a few famous martyrs and end with a few cautions and an exhortation. One type of persecution is verbal. Probably that includes quite a few different varieties. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you." I've just read the 8th of the 8 Beatitudes in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says we're blessed if we're poor in spirit, if we're peacemakers, and so forth. But he ends on this: blessed are those who are persecuted. Not people who are given a hard time or who suffer for whatever reason. It's when it's because of Christ. And so this includes things like slander, mockery, abuse of all sorts. Peter said, "For you've spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They're surprised that you don't join them in their reckless, wild living, and they heap abuse on you." I think a different version spoke of a flood of dissipation, just wasting your time and your resources, a flood. And that ties into the reference to the flood in the previous chapter. I was reading from 1 Peter 4. So slander, mockery, abuse, and accusations, typically misrepresentations. Three were particularly common in the early centuries of Christianity, before it became fashionable to follow Christ. And these are incest, atheism, and cannibalism. You might wonder, huh? How could Christians be accused of things like that? And I doubt very much that anyone listening to this talk has ever been accused of cannibalism. Well, here's why. Brothers married sisters. Okay, now you see where the incest comes from. It's Christians marrying Christians. Atheism, because Christians denied that the gods were real. In the Roman pantheon, you remember Jupiter and Juno, you had Mars and Apollo and Venus and all those guys. In the Greek pantheon, you had Zeus and Hera, Ares, Aphrodite, and so forth. And people were expected to honor those gods, at least to sacrifice to them occasionally, depending on what holiday it was and what part of the Roman Empire you lived in. Christians refused to do that. They refused to acknowledge that those gods were real, and thus they were called atheists. Cannibalism, and this has to do with the Lord's Supper. They were eating the flesh and drinking the blood of a baby. Well, sometimes that's how the rumor went. They're eating the Son of God. It's the communion. It's the Eucharist. And because they practice closed communion, only followers of Christ were permitted to participate. Everyone else was dismissed. So when they had their meal, it was behind closed doors. They couldn't prove that they weren't eating other people. Of course, it's a ridiculous accusation. But incest, atheism, cannibalism, if you read ancient historical sources, you'll see those come up all the time. But you know, it's okay. Jesus says, blessed are you when people hate you, exclude you, and insult you, and reject your name as evil because the Son of Man. And that's because that's how they treated him. And actually, it goes on a bit further. That's Luke 6, 22, 23. In verse 26, it actually says, woe to you if all men speak well of you. Well, my goal as a Christian, as a man, as a teacher of the scriptures, is not to turn people against me or to see how many people misrepresent me. Things like that will happen in the course of life, whether you're a Christian or not. It doesn't prove that you're following Christ just because you're persecuted. But Jesus seems to be saying that if we're not opposed by the world, if everyone always likes us, then we're in trouble. We're not taking a stand. So persecution could be verbal, and that includes the categories we've mentioned here of misrepresentation, crazy accusations, mockery, abuse, slander, and so forth. Another kind of persecution is confiscation. And we read about that in Hebrews chapter 10. When the government or the police turn against you and take your property, confiscation, not temporary confiscation. Recall the former days, the Hebrew writer says, when after you were enlightened, that's a reference to baptism, you endured a hard struggle with suffering, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, don't throw away your confidence. It's a very inspiring passage. Read the whole thing if you can. Confiscation, and people weren't lodging a complaint with the authorities. I want my property back. Well, you know, actually, I don't know that's true. Maybe they were. Maybe they tried. But I think the point was they were mistreated, they were plundered, and they accepted it, actually accepted it joyfully, the way that Jesus turned to the cross in Hebrews 12. But that's Hebrews 10. But confiscation was also quite common, particularly as more and more upper-class Romans were converted. They were under pressure to denounce Christ or lose their property. Of course, you wonder, well, who gets the property? Well, exactly. Is it the one who turns them in? Is it the local official? Is it someone higher up? It's corrupt. Then there's social exclusion. Not just not being invited to the party, but something more significant. For example, in the ancient Roman world, when you died, burial was a big deal. Who would take care of that? There were burial guilds. There were clubs that you would pay into so that your body would be disposed of. If you didn't have that, if you were a pauper, very sad. Not surprisingly, Christians stepped in, and one thing early Christians were known for was taking care of the burial of the poor, those who had no one, no family. That was just part of their love. And you didn't have to be a Christian to be buried. They would take care of that. But there were guilds. There were guilds for different skills, like leatherworking or the silversmiths, coppersmiths, people who did laundry and so forth. I mean, they're every career, it seems that there was a guild. And part of being in the guild would be attending dinners, which would be held in the honor of a god or goddess, and often in the very temple that god or goddess. You're expected to attend, to eat, and then partake, not just of the alcohol, but of the entertainment provided afterwards, which was normally courtesans, that is, professional prostitutes, and also little boys, pretty boys. Well, I think you can see that a lot of Christians would not join a guild if that's what they were expected to do, and so they were at an economic disadvantage. Often, false teachers will say, if you follow Christ, your finances will be better, you'll be healthy and wealthy, and well, that certainly wasn't the experience of the early church, and the apostles themselves were relatively poor. Read 1 Corinthians 4, as Paul talks about being dressed in rags. An extreme form of social exclusion is exile. And I used to think exile, that's not really that hard a punishment. It'd be, you know, harder if you were flogged or, you know, had life in prison. But exile. Well, think of John, the Apostle John, being exiled to the island of Patmos. And that happened sometime in the later part of the first century. We read about that in the book of Revelation. And I used to think, well, okay, so you've got a lot of downtime. You can catch up on, you know, your chores, or you can read, or, you know, you could enjoy nature. But the longer I've been a Christian, the more I've understood the emotional impact of being cut off from those who you care about and those who care about you. John, for example, was exiled off the coast of what is today Turkey, Asia Minor back then, and that's where his ministry was. In his later life, he was based in Ephesus, in that general area, and now he's cut off from them. That's a hard punishment, to be in exile. The loneliness and even the doubt and other things that come in. Right now, I don't know if you can hear it, but there's loud sirens going down the streets of Denver. I'm in snowy Denver for some conferences, just recording this during a break. The authorities are coming for you. You could be raided, your goods confiscated, you'll be misrepresented, you won't get due process. You could be exiled, you could be imprisoned. Something the Romans did was send people to the mines. You say the mines, like coal mines? Well, I guess it could be, but like silver mines, turquoise mines, and basically being worked to death. It's enslavement. And slavery is another form of opposition. And there's execution, of course, and imprisonment, which was mentioned in the passage that I just read. Imprisonment. And we think of imprisonment as, okay, if you do something bad, you'll be in prison for 5 or 10 years. If it's really bad, it might be 20 or 30 or life. In the ancient world, that's not the way prison was. It was normally a holding cell before they decided what to do with you, typically execution. They didn't provide meals. They might provide some dirty bread and a little bit of water, but you would die in prison if your friends or someone didn't come and help. And yes, here's another area where the early church stepped in and visited prisoners, not just prisoners who were there for their faith, but all kinds of prisoners. Christians are even known to have bribed the guards so that they could sneak into prisons and spend the night with a prisoner and make it less lonely. But imprisonment was not normally a long-term affair. It was very short. Execution, if you're a Roman citizen, you could be executed by beheading. If you weren't a citizen, there are other methods. Strangulation was not uncommon. By the way, the early church was strongly opposed to execution, and this is something that surprised me when I looked into the matter, and that was probably, I don't know, I guess after at least 20 or 25 years thinking the early church would be all on board with capital punishment. But actually, they opposed it. I don't think I found a single reference in favor. At any rate, these are different kinds of persecution. We're about to talk about martyrdom. Let me just do a quick summary. How were Christians persecuted? We mentioned imprisonment. Of course, there's execution, slavery, being sent to the mines, which was a combination of slavery and a death sentence, exile, social exclusion, exile typically far from your city or even outside of the country, social exclusion, so you're not welcome because you refuse to engage in the worldly practices and put you at economic disadvantage, confiscation, and all kinds of verbal persecution. I hope that makes sense. I hope I'm not saying too much here or too little. Let's transition to martyrdom, which is the ultimate in persecution. We read in the book of Revelation, they conquered him, that's the evil one, by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. At the end of the first century, Christians were increasingly in trouble with the government. And by the second century, it was actually illegal, technically, to be a Christian. And how did Christians overcome? Well, firstly, it's not just all on their own. It's by the blood of the Lamb. It's that trust in Christ. But it also says by the word of their testimony. That is, they didn't back down. They didn't give false testimony, pretending not to be Christians, or saying something that's not true, but by taking a stand. And they loved their lives It says, they love not their lives even unto death. So they didn't love their lives so much that they're willing to give up the faith. So Revelation 12:11, a key passage. Now, the word martyrdom comes from, obviously, the word martyr. And martyr comes from a word that simply means witness. Martyrs in the Greek New Testament. So it's someone who bears witness. But obviously, all Christians bear witness of their faith in Christ by the way we live. So this is talking about bearing witness to the utmost, in spite of the consequences when death follows. There's a difference between a martyr and a confessor. A confessor, and of course all Christians confess, but a confessor is one who could be martyred, but takes a stand, refuses to back down, but isn't killed, or maybe survives, whereas a martyr loses his or her life. An example of a confessor very well known is Nicholas of Myra. Nicholas was a church leader in the late 3rd century and early 4th century, and in the persecutions of the Romans, he refused to back down. And from the bones that have been discovered, his relics, it looked like his face got smashed in. It could well be he was beaten, but refused to back down. He was a strong person, well known for his care for the disadvantaged, for children and others. We know him sometimes as Saint Nick, but Nicholas was a real person. Myra is a town in on the Mediterranean coast of Turkey. It's a beautiful place to visit. He's an example of a confessor. So a martyr, of course, there's always the possibility of a reprieve, or you know, maybe something goes wrong, and the executioner's sword breaks in two, who knows. But willing to bear witness makes you a confessor in a time of persecution, and you suffer the consequences. Martyrdom if you die. Now, in the first couple of centuries, we have the first Christian martyr, Stephen. Of course, there's Jesus himself, who's the model of martyrdom. In fact, if you compare closely the account of Stephen's witness in Acts 7, I guess it starts in Acts 6, it's really all of chapter 7, and then we read about his death and burial in the beginning of chapter 8, we see that he's very much like Jesus. There are multiple parallels. Maybe that's a Bible study you'd like to do sometime. We had, of course, the apostles. And I don't know how many apostles died for their faith. I often hear all but one died an unnatural death. I guess it's possible. I've looked into this. From what I can see, looking at the ancient sources, at least 7 of them were martyred. It may well be more, but by my count, 7. And then we have famous second century martyrs, like the martyrs of Lyon in France, Ignatius, who was executed. He was from Antioch in Syria. He was executed in Rome and wrote letters, a number of letters to different churches on the way, which have survived and are quite fascinating. And this fellow seemed to be really looking forward to martyrdom. Now, I don't know, was Paul, the Apostle Paul, looking forward to martyrdom when we read 2 Timothy 4, probably his final letter? He was certainly looking forward to being with the Lord, but Ignatius was like, bring it on. Don't interfere. Don't anyone intercede for me. I look forward to my flesh being burnt and my bones being mangled by wild animals. And it's a bit macabre. I think Jesus, when he said, if they persecute you in one city, flee to another, Matthew 10, means that we should be willing to die, but it's not something that we should be seeking. Ignatius, so that he's killed in the first decade of the second century. You have people like Justin Martyr, Polycarp. There's so many stories, and maybe you've heard some of those. But what I thought I would do is focus more on the 3rd century. And I'd like to talk briefly about 4 famous 3rd century martyrs, although technically the last 2 were executed just a few years into the 4th century. Diocletian, a persecuting emperor, reigned from 284 on. His persecution ended in 305. So let's talk about a few of these. Let's see how many of them you've heard of before. Lawrence, who lived from 225 to 258. He was a strong Christian. He was a church leader. And the authorities ordered him to surrender the wealth of the church. That is, they assumed that they had money, which, after the time of Constantine, increasingly in the Middle Ages, the churches did have money. I don't know how much they had. Lawrence said, give me 3 days and I'll give you, I promise, I'll bring you the treasure. I'll bring you the wealth of the church. He asked for 3 days. Well, sneaky Lawrence, in those 3 days, whatever the church owned, he gave that all away to the poor. So it's all gone. And on the third day, when he shows up before the officer, he brings a bunch of poor people. And he says, these are the riches of the church. This is the treasure. You know, because people are more important than things. Well, the guy was so angry with him, he ordered him to be roasted alive. Lawrence is well known for saying, and maybe this is apocryphal, I don't know, but he was on a griddle, he was cooked, he was being roasted, and then eventually he said, I'm done on this side, you can turn me over. Whether he said it or not, that's an incredible spirit of confidence. When I was in Rome, where I believe that's where he was executed, I was in Rome a few days ago, I bought a coin it's the Emperor Valerian, 253 to 260. And he was one of the persecuting emperors, an emperor who issued a very harsh decree against the Christians. And then the next day he sent out a harsher Christian saying all church leaders must be executed. Wow. Valerian died in 260. He was in battle and the first Roman emperor ever captured by a foreign army. It was the Persians, and he was humiliated and tortured and killed. This is not a talk on Valerian. One day maybe we can talk about the Roman emperors. But that's Lawrence. And sometimes if you see pictures of him, you'll see a griddle, a barbecue, a fire, something like that. Saint Sebastian, and I'm using the Catholic titles. As a Christian, I understand we show respect to these people, but every Christian is meant to be a saint, Ephesians 1:1. And so to say someone is and someone isn't, if you're just talking about their lifestyle, I get it, but it's quite confusing. So Sebastian, 255 to 288. What did this guy do? Well, it turns out he was very effective evangelistically, and he converted many soldiers, Roman soldiers. Now, why would that be a problem? You know, normally the Romans didn't care what you believed, as long as you would participate in the civic ceremonies, the holidays. Occasionally that would mean some sacrifice to a god, maybe a sacrifice to the emperor. Well, there were three things that soldiers were expected to do. They're expected to take oaths. They were expected to offer sacrifices to the gods or to the emperor. And of course, they're expected to kill. And these are three things that Christian soldiers refused to do. The church was strongly opposed to this until the church really apostatized in 4th century. So by Sebastian converting a lot of soldiers, it means that these are people who, in one perspective, are useless for the army. I mean, what use are you if you're not going to kill people? Anyway, they came after Sebastian, and he was beaten severely. They tried to kill him. Eventually, he was shot to death with arrows, shot through with arrows. So you'll see tapestries or paintings of Sebastian with a lot of arrows sticking in him. That's your guy. So, and notice he was fairly young, you know, about 33 years old. Not that, maybe around the same age that Jesus was. Okay, Lucy. See, it's not just men who were executed. Martyrs included women as well. Lucy, 283 to 304, lived on the island of Sicily and in the town of Syracuse. And in a tour I was recently leading, we actually were right there. And I remember having a lunch at a restaurant called Agatha. Well, Agatha was a Christian who was martyred in the year 252. Lucy was martyred 52 years later. And so Syracuse, they're very proud of this. Lucy was born to rich parents, very rich. But even though there was the wealth, her father died when she was a little girl, leaving her and her mother quite vulnerable. She was 5 years old. Well, eventually, her marriage was arranged. She was going to marry a very wealthy pagan. Pagan, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean simply, he's not a Christian. He would believe in the gods. A young and wealthy pagan. So that's a real dilemma. Probably she didn't want to marry. They weren't really giving her much of a choice. and to be forced to marry someone who believed in multiple gods. This is not obviously a good situation spiritually. The story is she had a dream, and Agatha came to her in the dream and said, Lucy, you're going to be the glory of Syracuse. People are going to remember you. You're going to glorify God. So Lucy gives a lot of her wealth away to the poor. Her fiance, the pagan, reports her. I think he's really angry because this is, you know, when marrying her, he would basically be acquiring this wealth. So he reports her to the governor. The governor has her seized and commands her to sacrifice to the emperor. This is Diocletian. She says, no, absolutely not. She's sentenced to be defiled in a brothel. Basically, she's sent somewhere where she'll be abused sexually. And then the execution, to be drawn by oxen. So you've got an ox on each side of you attached by ropes, trying to literally pull your body in half. Apparently, that didn't work. They tried to burn her to death on a pyre. That didn't work. You know, of course, you wonder, is there some exaggeration here? I don't know. Eventually, they cut her throat, and she does die. But it was highly venerated, still is, in many parts of Europe and the rest of the world, Lucy. This is in the time of the Emperor Diocletian. By the way, that was the last major persecution against Christians. That lasted to 305. Persecution continued for another 5 or 6 years or so, but it was really a time of tremendous change. One more I'd like to mention, one martyr I respect called Catherine. Now, Catherine lived in Egypt. Her years are 287 to 305, which means she was still a teenager when she was martyred. She lived in Alexandria, Egypt. She was educated, apparently really educated, and people liked her, and she converted hundreds of people to the faith. And she was executed on a wheel, on the wheel. Look it up if you want to see some pictures, but a very painful way to die. So I wanted to mention these four very famous martyrs, most of whose lives were lived in the 3rd century, Lawrence, Sebastian, Lucy, Catherine. I wonder what other names we would add even today. Now, even though I share about these men and women, Jesus is our example, the attitude we should have about life and death. Often we're tempted to think, well, if it came to it, I would die for my faith. I would not denounce Jesus. I would not pretend to be a non-Christian. I would hang in there. And I hope that everyone listening to this talk would do just that. But as someone said, it's hard to imagine that we would die for Christ if we're not willing to live for him. So the question for me and for you is, are we living for Christ? Are we living for him? I'd like to give one caution and then one challenge, and then we'll end this talk, which I hope has not been too heavy. One caution, beware exaggeration and also sentimentality. You may have heard that the Apostle John was boiled in oil, and he survived. In fact, it didn't even hurt him. He hopped out unscathed. That's a tradition about the Apostle John. Well, if he was lowered in boiling oil, I suppose he could have survived. Doesn't seem very likely. But I ask, how old is that tradition? Is that really true? The Apostle Paul. I was reading an apocryphal work called The Acts of Paul. This is written 100 years after most of his letters. It's certainly not accurate in many ways. But in The Acts of Paul, he is executed by a Roman soldier. Soldier decapitates him. Of course, Paul's a Roman citizen, so he gets the sword. And then instead of blood spurting out, milk spurts out and gets all over the cloak of the executioner. Doesn't seem very likely, does it? Outside Rome, where Paul, and there is strong evidence that Paul was executed just outside Rome along the Appian Way, and that his bones are under a certain structure, which you can visit today. But there's a place called Tre Fontane, Three Fountains. When his head came off, it bounced 3 times. And each place it bounced created a spring. You know, fresh water came up. And okay, come on. This is exaggeration. I think we need to distance ourselves from things that are purely, legendary. But it's not just ancient or even medieval stories, even modern stories. I remember once someone told me that three Christians were martyred, had just been martyred, I think, a day or two earlier in Russia. And I thought, okay, if that's true. I just asked some questions, looked into it. Well, they were attacked by robbers. Oh, okay. Why were they martyred then? Were they sharing their faith? Well, it seems they were probably resisting, and so all three of them were killed. To call them martyrs, though, you know, I assume that they died in the grace of God, but that's not what being a martyr is. Martyr has to do with execution following on your testimony. Sometimes people die in the line of duty. It might be a policeman or a fireman. Someone is engaged in a just cause and is killed by maybe criminal interest. Is that martyrdom? I think we need to be very careful how we use that word. That's my caution. Now the challenge. Let's be aware. Maybe you live in a country where it's easy to be a Christian, or where we think it's easy. There are some 80 countries out of close to 200 in the world. Some 80 countries where it's dangerous to be a Christian, or at least extremely inconvenient. And a number of those countries, if you live as a Christian, you'll be executed. So this is not theoretical material, and I'm just not just speaking about history, the early church. If you want to know more about this, for probably 20 or 30 years now, I've been getting updates on martyrdoms and opposition, and you can sign up for these updates at persecution.org. Let's close with our scripture in Revelation one more time. And they conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. God bless you.